evening. Can everybody hear me all right? Yeah? Good. Excellent. Burrito good? Yeah, I'm going to get one later, but probably not a good idea to eat and talk at the same time. So I'm Brian Germain. You probably figured that one out. So just a little bit about me, just so you kind of know where I'm coming from. One of the things that I do is I'm an author, and I've written a number of books. And one of them is called Transcending Fear, and it relates to it's not specifically a skydiving book. Obviously, you know, I teach skydiving advanced stuff, and I found that the fundamental limiting factor in somebody's performance is how they relate to their fear. How do they deal with their adrenaline? And I found that people that could not control their adrenaline had more problems. And I figured, well, obviously I need to teach them parachute aerodynamics. I need to teach them hard science stuff that saves their butt. Nevertheless, if we don't kind of deal with the emotional aspect of who we are, we're missing half of the equation. At least half of the equation, maybe even more. So, just a little bit about me. I've jumped out of airplanes over 13,000 times. I've been doing it for a while, about 23 years. And a number of years ago, I won the X Games, which has given me the opportunity to do a lot of teaching all over the planet. So every week, I'm in a different place, in many cases, a different country, teaching this stuff. And I did go to school for psychology, undergrad and grad school. So when I get into a little bit of the psych stuff, it's not totally out of my butt. So some of it is. So let's start off with the general idea of fear. And then we have physiological stuff, and you guys are trained in that aspect of it. Immediately comes to mind several different physiological processes that gear the body up to act, correct? So I would simplify it, though, for the sake of this discussion, into two general categories of action, things that I have discovered as a skydiving instructor, what tends to happen when people get their adrenaline up into the red zone, the red line. The first set of possibilities is intense overreaction. Hyperactivity. It might just be simple nervous energy. Ever notice your knees tapping when you're getting ready to take an exam or during the exam or through the entire exam? Right? Extra energy that's in our bodies. The other part, in the higher realms of it, we start to see a different possible scenario. Intense underreaction. People don't always pull their ripcords. Fortunately, we have automatic openers now, and so the parachute comes out all by itself. But then you look at the situation afterwards and go, why? I mean, it's a big planet. You know, it's really obvious. Why doesn't somebody look down and go, wow, it's time to open the parachute? There's all kinds of cues, visual, temperature cues, it gets warmer. You know that the planet's there, and yet they are tuned out. Or they have a malfunction, the parachute is clearly not working, and they don't cut it away and open their reserve. Why do they freeze? And so to really answer these questions, we need to go deeper, I think. We need to look at where fear comes from an evolutionary standpoint. It's an emotional response, which is physiological and cognitive, but it's based on a perceived threat, right? It's not always a physical threat. You know, I mean, a train is about to hit you and you get the adrenaline and you jump out of the way with tremendous force. That's coming from your limbic system, right? Saying, go, right? But the perceived threat could be an exam. It could be performance anxiety. You're about to give a talk in front of a bunch of med students. How do you deal with the excess adrenaline? You're all going to be dealing with that in your career. And some of it's just going to be dealing with crises, things that are happening. The lady's having a baby. You can't push the pause button on it so much. You know? And so there's going to be adrenaline. There's going to be intense stress. And I'd have to say that your limbic system doesn't know the difference between that kind of stressor and what I deal with when I'm test jumping an experimental parachute that I built in my basement. I do it all the time. The truth is that the brain structures don't see a difference. There's a cognitive appraisal where I weigh out my perceived ability against my perceived risk, and if I feel out of balance with that, in other words, my perceived ability is low for a risk that I consider to be really intense, very real, I'm going to have a fear response. Of course, what I do with that is up to me. We can become skilled in dealing with our adrenaline. So to go even deeper, this physiological arousal is getting us ready to, I'm having a little trouble with my clicker, sorry, basic survival instincts. Our genes have behaviors encoded in them. Some of them are the need to breathe. Some of them are the need to eat. Some of them are escape danger, survive. Exactly how that works, I don't know that anybody can say absolutely, but we do know that it seems to be the case, that there are stereotypical behavior patterns that are intended to increase the chances of an animal being able to live long enough to breed, right? That's what it's all about. You don't pass on your genes come to a dead end. So when we find ourselves in a situation where there's perceived danger, our first instinct is generally to hold still, to do nothing. Because action might precipitate something that we don't want. Take the predator and prey relationship that exists in nature at all times. If the prey runs away, they have lost their ability to hide. And so the predator has their trigger go on, right, because of the movement, the retreat, and so now there is an attack as a result of the retreat. And so freezing is our first line of defense. The problem is, freezing is not always a good thing, especially when it comes to the point where it's post-traumatic stress disorder, people are no longer functional, we don't make choices when we need to make choices. We don't get off our asses and study when we need to study because we're scared to even think about the upcoming exam. Laziness comes from it too. Disengaging. And it is now believed that the freezing instinct is not just a short-circuiting in the brain that goes, you know, I have too much juice in my body. That maybe the freezing instinct is actually coming from something a little bit more valuable to the species, at least traditionally. It's just that our old defense mechanisms don't necessarily apply. We're trying to ram a square peg into a round hole in modern society. The basic actions that get us out of dangerous situations traditionally were run away. If you got wings, fly away. If you got a flagella, you flap it like crazy and get out of Dodge, right? Whatever you need to do to escape the danger. The other one is you attack. Force against force. The emotion of anger stems from this. So fear and anger are not different. It's just a different evolution of it. When people are driving down the road scared that they're going to be late for work, if you really strip away the anger and you really think about what's going on, they're just afraid to be late. And so now, and then they pull out the Magnum and start shooting holes in somebody's car. We have a problem in our society with anger. It's not a terribly productive emotion unless you're trying to kill a bear that is trying to kill you. We don't run into that very often anymore. At least I don't. I don't know about you guys. So we have these basic primal instincts built in. And when the adrenaline gets up above a certain level, we start to see significant changes in the cognitions that occur to us and the behavior patterns that come out. And they're generally not terribly beneficial. So I think that in order to really understand that stuff and how to diminish that, to keep us away from the red line, we have to do a brief review of what goes on in the brain, right? The amygdala. It's the watchdog in the brain, old brain structure. Been around for a while, before we were clever, before we were making tools, we had amygdalas. And so that amygdala goes, something's going on. There's danger. I am threatened. And I need to do something about it. And it sends a whole cascading of events. And you guys can explain this probably way better than I do. Maybe not the first years. there is a hostile takeover of the brain. And obviously we have a squirt of all kinds of things like epinephrine and norepinephrine, the steroid hormone, cortisol, all kinds of stuff changing in the body. The heart rate, the blood pressure. We get stronger, physically stronger up to a point, and then anybody that has, you ever go rock climbing and get yourself too scared and suddenly you can't climb anymore? Beyond a certain level, it turns out to have the law of diminishing return, doesn't it? We lose power. We lose our ability to perform. A dancer going up on stage, dressed like a ballet dancer, too scared, not a ballet dancer, right? We need to have our stress level low enough that we can perform, not just physically, but intellectually as well, to be able to conjure things that we've learned in a lower arousal state. You ever hear of state-specific learning? It's very real. Yeah, so if you learn in a lower arousal state and you take a test at twice that heart rate, you're not in the same room in the house. You're not going to be remembering things, which is why I have a problem with scared parachutists not pulling their handle when they need to. I do my best to save all of them, but the truth is I can't, because these brain structures override my teaching. They say attack, retreat, or hide. That's it. That's all you got for your solution set once you get your heart rate and blood pressure and everything up to this level. The interesting part for me is that we start to see significant changes in brain activity also. It's not just the changing in the basic physiology, but you look at a PET scan, positron emission tomography, that kind of stuff, you can see what's going on in somebody's head, more or less. You can see the brain structures that are activated and the ones that are deactivated. And we start to see dramatic shifting in the balance of power. Right to left half. One way to describe the right and left hemispheres in terms of activity is intellect and emotion. Logic on one side, gut on the other. Of course, if we get too much adrenaline, we start to see less activity on the left side of the brain, particularly in the left prefrontal cortex. We need that part of our brain to be who we really want to be, I think. That's interesting. And I've been thinking about it. Why would we lose our ability to think logically when we get into serious danger? Maybe my logic presents too many barriers to my action. Maybe it makes me second guess myself. I can't kill a bear. I'm just this little guy. And this thing says, maybe you can. It takes away the logic. Problem is, sometimes we need a little logic. We also see... Oh, there we go. This is an actual... So you know I'm not making this stuff in Microsoft Paint. So you can actually see the shifting in the balance of power over to the right side of the brain. We also see less activity in the front part of the brain, where we have decision making. Too much adrenaline, and we aren't so good at surveying the scene carefully, thinking it through. Right? You ever see somebody arrive in a car accident? Cars start to burn, people start running around, the voices get higher, and they go faster and faster and faster, and nobody's thinking carefully. Nobody's actually deciding what the right thing to do. And so one person comes up and goes, "All right, everybody be quiet, here's what we're going to do. I need you to call 911. You have a cell phone? Yes, that's your job. You come with me, we're going to get the kid out of the car." Right? The person that speaks quietest and clearly, calmly, keeps their heart rate down is the one that allows their brain to still be what it could be. Willed action. So the paralyzing effects of fear, the freeze stuff, may have something to do with this as well. The left prefrontal cortex getting deactivated. We lose our ability to act when we need to act. And of course, epiphany, the outside the box, aha kind of thing, comes from the front part of the brain that isn't working so well because there's too much juice. And interestingly, our ability to regulate emotion is robbed when we have all this emotion. That's a problem. So why minimize fear? Well, I would have to say it's because adrenaline is inversely proportional to higher intelligence, higher cognitive functioning. Arousal makes us a little bit stupid. and we revert back to old coping mechanisms. We become this fella. I would say, though, that we've evolved beyond that. We have the capability of demonstrating more than just attack, retreat, and hide. We also have the possibility of using our intellect to de-escalate the situation so that we can use our new instincts, our new coping mechanisms, access our knowledge to be more than just a Cro-Magnon. So in that case, we'd have to say we have more than just attack retreat. We can consider conscious advance towards empowered advance. If you use the emotion, that can be a good thing. Empowered retreat. You know where you're going and why you're going instead of just running like a lunatic. Right? You see the soccer games where there's a big stampede because the wrong team lost and people get stepped on and killed. Right? Unconscious retreat. Humans are a very dangerous animal once we get into that red zone. But we also have to consider the possibility that when we're in the freeze state, we have the ability to soften, slow down, and appraise the situation from a big picture. Alter the state of affairs. Alter the way the situation evolves. To wake up. I can't say that I don't get scared when I jump out of airplanes. That would be lying. But I do notice that I'm scared earlier than many people. And I do something about it. I wake up to it. And of course, we're going to, as we continue on, some of the coping mechanisms that have been very effective for me, and they're grounded in some pretty reasonable ideas. So the process of de-escalating, and of course, when we de-escalate ourselves, we can de-escalate situations as well. You have to address it first, physically, and then cognitively. You ever hear of this fella? Learn him. James Ross, one of the most brilliant thinkers of our time. What he had to say about emotion was kind of groundbreaking. It's pivotal, and it changed the way that I look at my own emotional experience. It is his belief, or was, he's long since dead, that the mind's interpretation of the body's state of arousal is inseparable from the experience of emotion. So in other words, there's a bottom-up hierarchy. When we get to the higher levels of juice, our intellect cannot cool us down anymore. Think about it. When you're freaked out about something, and I'm sure there's lots of reasons to be freaked out when you're a med student. Just thinking about the student loans gets my panties in a bunch. I cannot say to myself, Brian, just calm down. It's no big deal. Or if I address the problem and I think about the problem and I look at, maybe if I can look at it from a different angle, if I can study hard enough or whatever, maybe that'll, it doesn't seem to work. That I have to address it in a bottom-up manner until I slow my body down. Until I actually control my physical response. I cannot get my brain working again. In other words, even when you don't feel it, act on it. You're sitting in an airplane, you're about to jump out, don't fidget. You're making it worse. Don't tap your knee, don't look all around. Relax, lean back against the person behind you and soften the muscles. Don't give the energy any place to go. James, as far as I'm concerned, was right on the money. Well, wait a minute. So you're saying that if I'm running from a bear that's chasing me, I'm scared because I'm running? And you're saying basically yes. That is precisely what I'm saying. Is that if you don't use the energy, the body sends messages to the brain. And so as a result of the climate of the body, the thoughts that occur to us because of this different mood, if you will, are different. Our solution set is different. We get tunnel vision when we get scared, when we get into negative thinking, into paranoia thinking. We only see the problem. And of course, we don't solve problems by focusing on the problem indefinitely. We examine the problem and then we create a solution. You're worried about the test? Study. Right? But first, calm yourself down so that your brain is working enough that you can study. Step one, dealing with a adrenaline, dealing with fear, is always to relax the body. It has to be. Otherwise, you're just throwing rocks at a tornado. Slow down. I find that when I run to the airplane really fast, and of course, it's quite common for me. I've got multiple parachutes, and very often they're all unpacked, and they need me on that load, and I'm running to the airplane, putting my leg straps on. Oh, these goggles on, they throw me the goggles, and I jump onto the plane, and the rig isn't even on me yet. Now I've got even more work to do to get myself to slow down my heart rate, to cool out, so that my body can alter the climate of my thoughts. I have to reduce my activity level, reduce the needs of my body. And of course, that kicks in parasympathetic systems. Totally different reality. Something that I learned about breathing. You're going to love this diagram. This is an actual photo of real lungs. You guys know about how the diaphragm works, right? It's a muscle. And when you inhale, it flexes and flattens. That's work. The inhaling, right? You just sneak up behind somebody and you goose them. So it has been taught to me when I'm doing high altitude mountaineering, or I'm jumping out of the airplane at 23,000 feet with no oxygen on, or any kind of high stress situation, they always tell me, focus on the exhale. And I always wonder what that was all about. And I'm realizing that it makes sense that if the exhaling is a relaxation of my diaphragm, and if I can sort of, I like to think of it as putting a parachute on my exhale, and I sort of, when I'm really stressed out, and I just can't get my thoughts under control, if I focus on my breathing, focus on the exhale, slow down, now I push the reset button. Now I can create a new set of possibilities that are positive. That I could feel good about the situation, take all that thing, whatever it is that I was scared about, and go, let's do it. Let's attack this with positive energy. Solve the problem. Study, whatever it is. The other thing that I found very interesting is that the parietal lobe of the brain, responsible for orientation in space, in the absence of input, when it's not orienting me in space, trying to figure out what's going on, it actually kicks in parasympathetic systems. When I hold my eyes still for a period of time, that alone is called deafferentation. You ever sit still really, really for a long time and you focus just on one place and then the light changes and everything looks kind of weird? It's that. That's deafferentation. And we can use that sort of bottom-up effect to change the way we feel. And if we change the way we feel, we can create completely different situations, different outcomes. So this is part of relaxing. Under parachute, one of the things that I always teach my students to do, because, of course, they're pretty freaked out. You just jumped out of an airplane. Now you open the parachute, and for a moment, you don't know what's going to happen. Is it going to open or not? It opened up. Now, of course, if you carry all that adrenaline all the way to the ground, your landing is going to stink. You're going to crash into the ground more often than not. So I teach them to put the parachute into brakes and take a deep breath and relax their muscles and look at the horizon and sink into that harness and don't look around for a little while. Just enjoy being there. Appreciate it. I think that's a nice thing to have in our heads, you know, when you really get to that point. And I know you're not scared right now. You know, it's a little hard to get into that headspace. But if you can, for just a moment, imagine what it's like when you really get scared. And I know you all have amygdalas. To wake up to the fact that you're freaking out. Take a moment. Create some space in your day, even if it's just 5 seconds. To stop, clear your head, and then go. I remember being on jump run. I was in a tailgate airplane. At the X Games, and ESPN's there with their big-ass cameras. I mean, it's scary enough to jump out of the airplane, but here we are in competition where, you know, this matters. We've been training really hard. We got sponsors behind us. There's money involved if we win or lose. And so here I am having to give an interview on the way to altitude on the last round when we were neck and neck for the lead. And of course, by the end of that interview, I was pretty frazzled. You know, I really had a lot of uncomfortable feeling about my situation. And I was starting to have thoughts like, what if I blow the exit? You know, what are we supposed to do on this one? I can't remember. And instead of asking my teammate, what am I supposed to do on this one? I took a minute, I sat down, I relaxed, and I kind of meditated for a little while, and then I remembered everything. Because I got in touch with the feeling of succeeding. And it all came back from there. And we won. So focusing is another step in the process of cooling ourselves out. We get our bodies to relax, and now that opens the door, the possibility to focus our minds on whatever it is that we want. And it seems to me that ultimately what causes fear is negative thought patterns. Fixating on what doesn't make us feel good. And if we keep fixating on it, things will not change. We will not be able to change our affect, our mood. It's not going to happen. So then the question comes, how do we cultivate non-attachment to thinking? Can we actually train the brain, train an individual to have a different set of responses to the same situation? So you guys familiar with the idea of neuroplasticity? The brain can change through experience. Everything you learn, every new concept, every new experience you have, it actually alters your brain. Literally, physically. And so if we repeatedly do things that cool us down, we're going to become a cooler person. That's the assertion. And it is my experience, coming from somebody who was terrified of heights, not making this up. I jump out of airplanes for a living. Okay, the truth is that I talk for a living, but I talk about jumping out of airplanes. So, neuroplasticity in action. The idea is very, very simple. That if fixating on something that makes us feel like crap is the problem, we need to get good at letting go of thought in general, whatever the thought is, and focusing on what then? Do you substitute? You know, do you go to your happy place? Yeah, okay, maybe, but we don't always have a happy place to conjure. And it's a long jump, in my experience, from feeling like crap to feeling great. And in between there is not thinking. Part of my graduate school program was we took all the psych grad students up into the mountains and we meditated for an entire month. All we did was stare at carpet for a month. The most boring class I've ever taken. Okay, second most boring, but that's another story. And what I've discovered is that if I do that for a long period of time, my thought patterns change. My ability to let go of a thought that is, you know, kind of pointed in the wrong direction becomes better. And if my problem is that I'm fixating on negative thinking, I can't. Boy, I get a lot of students, you know, they say, well, I can't land well. I got a problem. I'm just not a good lander. And I say, well, either you need to change your attitude or you need to quit skydiving. So if we can sit down from time to time on a bench, on the grass, or whatever, and periodically, every day, meditate, it turns out that we can actually change ourselves significantly. It's been a very empowering thing for me and a lot of my students. So the idea is very simple, right? You're trying to focus on the present moment, but then you have a thought, and that thought might be, I'm hungry. The thought might be, I'm horny. They come up. Whatever it is, the thoughts come up. When you're human, the only way to stop thinking is to hit yourself on the head with a great big hammer. I'm sure you can think of several medications that would also accomplish the same goal. But when the thought comes up, instead of following it like chasing a rabbit, you let it go. And you return to noticing your breath, noticing the sounds and smells, you know, right now. And you return to now. And then you trip out again. And then you return again. And if we do this on a regular basis, there are changes to our brain, to our tendencies. And when the fear comes up, we have the ability to say, thank you for sharing. Thank you for giving me that very, very salient, clear picture of what the worst case scenario would be so that I can avoid it. And I'm going to let that go. Because if we focus on what we don't want, we get it. So the idea is to very simply notice our thoughts and label them thinking. That's the Tibetan way of doing it. Just label it and let it go, whatever it is. You let them go and you return to the present moment. Try it on. See the words. I'm sure that many of you are already on this trip, and that's great. So the idea, for me anyway, is to not think of the absence of thought as kind of an empty space, but actually the place where I start to feel good again. That's my experience. But there's a new number in the metric called positive zero. So why is it so important to let go of negative thought patterns? And I'd have to say simply because it comes down to this. Thinking creates your reality. Your personal reality is altered. People that fixate on negative thoughts, I hope that doesn't happen, you know. I know you're going to cheat on me. Well, you bring it about. I know that I'm going to lose altitude awareness on this one. And then they open them very low. It's called the law of attraction, and as far as I can tell, it's the truth. What we repeat in our minds over and over and over again has a neuroplastic effect, just like meditating does. I can't. I'm not any good at that. I'm not smart. These affirmations echo in our brains, and they create who we are, which means that we can change it by repeating something different. Very simple. I've noticed a phenomenon in the skydiving world. If there's a field of grass with one tree in it, a scared skydiver is going to hit it. It's amazing. I mean, I used to live in Zephyr Hills, Florida. It's one of the meccas of skydiving. It's near Tampa. I used to live there. And there's one stand tree, and it has parachute line burns all over it. It's incredible. They fixate on what they don't want to do, and they can't take their eye off it. I know I'm going to fail, and the failure happens. This is why I teach transcending fear, because it's so pivotal for people's lives. If you can get away from fixating on what makes you feel like crap and focus on your solution, life can change. Our focus of attention is very simple, right? We have the ability to shift it. That's what creates our emotional experience. Focusing on the object of our fear will increase the magnitude of the fear response. And that promotes negative thought patterns. We fixate on the object of the fear, worst case scenario, trips going on. I bounced once. I crashed into the ground so hard that the doctors were shocked that I lived based on the damage in my body. It was a collapse. My parachute folded up. And, of course, it's why I ended up going to parachute design, to try to solve the problem. But in the first year after my recovery, after I got out of the wheelchair, after I got off the crutches, after I got off the cane, after I got out of the PT and got myself strong enough and finally started jumping, I found the image of my worst case scenario, that ground rushing up, repeating in my mind. And it turns out that emotion connects to memory, that they're not separate things. As a matter of fact, emotion is what empowers memory. It's what lights it up, what dog ears the page in our consciousness. And the more emotion you have associated with the context, the more it becomes a long-term memory. This is why trauma is so hard to get rid of. And so we need to, you know, kind of recognize when we've got these things and take it on. You're scared of heights because something bad happens? Do things that aren't as scary but are, you know, involve heights a little bit. Otherwise, you're going to be boxed in the rest of your life. And that's not fun, because there are a lot of fun things you can do up high. I find that when I'm in a negative state of mind, all I do is look for danger. My mind is on this seek mode of, well, how is this bad? How is it going to go bad? How is this going to turn out to be horrible? And as a result, I find myself unable to soothe myself. So then the alternative comes in. So, a lot of New Agey stuff about positive thinking out there that's annoying. Because it sounds so frou-frou or whatever, you know, it sounds... Positive thinking, I think it comes down to this. When you're in a situation that doesn't look good and there's no cue in your environment that says that things are going to change, that things are going to get better, that they're going to turn a corner, out of nowhere, you have the ability to consider the possibility that things are going to go well, that everything's actually going to be all right. Where did that come from? Is it your knowledge of who you are based on who you've been? Maybe. Or it could just be your decision to always consider the possibility that everything's going to be all right. That's where self-soothing comes from, I think. That's the big cognition that goes, all right, okay, maybe I've been making a case for the worst-case scenario, building it up in my mind, and something that Richard Bach once said that I really like. Argue for your limitations, and you get to keep them. I like that one. So positive visualization is also a big piece of this. We have to envision the specific steps, the ways to create the best case scenario. You know, we disengage from the negative trip, we calm ourselves down first so that we can see those possibilities, and then we see what do I have to do to solve this problem? What's the way? You focus your mind on anything else, and you're just making it worse. There's always some sort of a solution, even if it means just escape. And that brings us to what I would call the opposite of the fear state. Human consciousness has a full spectrum of possibilities, and one of them is the ultimate contracted state of who you are, where you're not allowing yourself to really expand and grow and learn and be the best that you can be. The other side is the flow state. Csikszentmihalyi, you guys ever read Flow? The Psychology of Optimal Experience? Great book. A little thick. You don't have to read the whole thing. You'll get the gist of it. I'll give you a clip notes. So it's a state of meditation and motion. When you're taking a test and you know the answers and you're just like, oh, I got this one, oh, I got this one, right? You feel kind of a flow through that experience. When you're swimming and you're in kind of a nice rhythmic mode, or you're jogging, or a concert pianist that knows that piece, you know, with every fiber of their being, and they sit down and their ego is dissolved. While they're doing it, they are the task. There's no separation between who they are and the unfolding, the perfect unfolding of this. The best case scenario is already done. Because they walk into it knowing what it feels like to succeed in that specific thing. Because they can picture it, they can feel it. This is where we see our optimal performance. Obviously, we're focused now. That's what's creating it on the best case. And we're completely absorbed in the moment, and time slips away. Which is why skydivers have audible altimeters. Might have clocks in the walls to detect. You don't lose track of time in that. But when we're in these really hyper-focused states, we can really lose track of time. It's interesting. And in my experience is when we're in a heightened flow state, a really joyful flow state where you know what you're doing and you're surrendering to the experience and you're allowing yourself to become sort of simple in that moment, there's no room for fear. There's no space in your head for that at all. So things like yoga, meditation, contemplative walking, these things can help us to build the space in our consciousness for that experience. We can learn what it's like to be in a flow state. And then we can apply that to other things in our lives. But I know that there's a lot of people walking around this earth that have never really experienced the flow state. So I say, go to something simple. Go through a yoga class. You know, something that involves flow. And notice what that's like. Because this whole transcending fear trip that I'm on, it's not about avoiding fear. It's about creating opposite. So ultimately, here's how I have found the answer to dealing with fear. Step one, calm your body down. Slow down. Don't use it. Slow down. Step two is draw your attention away from what's scaring you for a moment. Focus on empty-headedness or something that makes you feel good. And focus on that feeling so that you can start to kind of sober up from the bad feeling into the good feeling, because that's where good stuff comes from. And then, of course, then we have to allow ourselves to surrender. Do what you got to do to get through that situation. What's next? What's next? What's next? That's the flow state. And then, when the flow gets too fast and you get out of control and you start to feel your panties in a bunch again, repeat. Right? Return step one. We have to change from feeling like a victim. You know? The passenger in the back seat, when the bumps in the airplane start shaking there and you tighten your seatbelt and you feel powerless to solve your problems. If you feel like that within your own mind and the way you relate to your own emotions, it doesn't feel very good. And it holds us back if we can't control our emotions. That's the fundamental thing. I mean, you think back, there was lots of kids in school that were smart that ended up pumping gas or flipping burgers because they couldn't control their emotions enough to focus their attention and do what they had to do. They had attitude. They had anger issues. They had shyness as a result of fear. But you guys are here because you have some degree of emotional intelligence, enough that you jump through the hoops and here you are. And I commend you for it, truly. You're being the pilot. The pilot of your emotional experience, the pilot of your life, grabbing the yoke. And it's a different way to look at your life when you decide, I'm in control. I'm not going to allow my emotions to win. That's a hostile takeover of the consciousness by emotion. It's the horse running and the rider just squeezing it onto the horn, holding on for dear life. We are in control of the horse if we act like it, if we believe that we can. Then anything's possible. Thank you for coming.